This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Keri Phillips, and this is Rear Vision. We humans have had an interest in the weather, probably for as long as we've been around. Over the last two centuries, though, we've learned how to predict pretty accurately the weather that's coming our way. And in this Rear Vision, we'll hear how that happened.
Cyclone Debbie is 400 kilometres off Townsville, tracking towards the towns of Eyre and Home Hill. The Weather Bureau's Adam Blazak says Debbie is expected to cross the coast tomorrow morning as a severe Category 4 storm with 200 kilometre an hour winds.
Authorities have ordered everyone out of the Lismore CBD in northern New South Wales as floodwaters threaten to spill over the town's levee.
The Wilsons River is just centimetres from spilling over the levee when it reaches 10.6 metres. And the Bureau of Meteorology is warning it could rise to 11 metres later this morning.
While for most of us, the weather forecast is useful in terms of decisions about umbrellas and coats, it can also be a matter of life and death, as we've seen recently with the floods on the East Coast. So it's not surprising that the pioneers of forecasting in the 19th century had very practical reasons for wanting to predict the weather.
We see the first scientific weather forecasting in the 19th century. In the early part of the century, many nations formed their first networks of acquiring atmospheric data. Hello, I'm Christine Harper. I'm a professor of the history and philosophy of the earth sciences at the Department of Science Education, University of Copenhagen. They were basically recording temperature and pressure because that was basically all they had equipment for. And over time, there were attempts to systematize that and gather information and record it and then see if they could figure out what the weather was going to be for the next day. And that was particularly critical for shipping. People who are aboard ship really need to have a sense of what the weather is going to be. And in coastal areas, that's particularly important for fishermen. And of course, it's also important for anyone who's working outside. So farmers were very much interested in this as well. So we see this collection of data from the U.S. side. We see people like Matthew Fontaine Maury, who was collecting information from ship's logs, and he was primarily interested in ocean currents and winds so that ships could travel on the best routes, sailing ships, and get there faster and deliver goods and then get back with more goods. And we see Admiral Fitzroy in Great Britain doing the same thing, first starting from the shipping side and then trying to do forecasting for the public and having that in a very public fashion in newspapers and otherwise getting the word out.
How successful were Fitzroy's early forecasts?
I'm afraid that the poor early forecasters really were hammered by the public. Having been an operational weather forecaster myself, I could tell you that no matter what you forecast, somebody's going to be unhappy. But they were particularly unhappy, I think, because they anticipated that if you were making a forecast, it should be exactly right, as if you were doing some kind of physics experiment and you would get the exact right answer on the other side. And meteorology and the atmosphere just don't operate that way. So I would say that the earliest forecasts weren't terribly successful. On a day-to-day basis, quite frankly, people who have lived in an area for a very long time and who work outside, so farmers and fishermen and the like, would have been able on their own to figure out what the weather was going to be the next day just by reading the sky. Because they worked outside and they'd lived in the same place for many years, and they could tell by the different cloud patterns what kind of weather was inbound.
The sailing boat skippers knew a lot about the global wind patterns, like the roaring 40s and the trade winds and the doldrums. They knew all about those because they were involved in them so much. Yes, hello. Look, my name is Richard Whittaker. I'm a meteorologist. In fact, I have been involved in meteorology for over 50 years now, most of my career with the Bureau of Meteorology. And they had all sorts of sayings. A famous one is, mare's tails and mackerel scales make tall ships take in their sails. That means mare's tails is a cloud formation that we call cirrus stratus today, and the mackerel scales, we know that as alto cumulus. And both those sorts of clouds are associated with approaching cold fronts. Also, you mentioned farmers. Now, of course, that was very much dependent on the weather, as, of course, it still is today. And they had all sorts of sayings. There's an interesting one called St. Swithin's Day. If ye know rain for 40 days, it will remain. That's July the 15th, St. Swithin's Day, which is high summer in Europe and England. And that refers to the persistence of high pressure across Europe and England during midsummer. You had to have 4 days of dry weather for cutting hay. So they had those sort of sayings to help them predict what was going to happen.
Scientists, especially astronomers, started gathering weather data in the early 19th century, but it wasn't much use in terms of producing a forecast until a way of transmitting that information quickly was developed in the 1840s.
Yes, Kerry, look, I think probably one of the big moments was not really connected with the weather at all, but it was Samuel Morse, who was a co-inventor of the electric telegraph. It was known for quite some time, particularly in America, if there was stormy weather on the west coast of America, quite often that would move right across the country and start affecting the east coast. So it was long believed that if a communication system that moved faster than the weather could be developed, then a warning system could be put together. The problem was there was no way of communicating information faster than the weather could move until Samuel Morse and his telegraph came along. And when that was linked up across America, it was realised that when bad weather was on the West Coast, for instance, that information could be transmitted right across America, and warning of bad weather was evolved from that.
So with telegraph, you had the opportunity of sharing data rather quickly. And then the problem was, well, what do you do with it now that you've got it? I mean, if I've got a bunch of temperatures and pressures and maybe information on rain in a big list, that doesn't help me. So you see people working on making the first weather maps and how that would be able to be analyzed to give you information about what's coming in the areas that are upstream from you and then what'll happen downstream from you. But it's still not standardized until after World War I. And so consequently, all these national groups were making weather observations and compiling them for their countries, but they were taking them in all of these different times. I mean, people weren't taking them at the same time of the day all around the world. They were just taking them, I won't say that they were random times, but and then there was an agreement on when everyone would make their observation. There was a worldwide agreement to do that. It was decided to use Greenwich Mean Time as the common time for everybody, so people weren't taking all of these at local time. So they agreed that the weather observations would be taken every 6 hours, which gives you 4 observations a day, and that would start at 00 Greenwich Mean Time. So at 00, 06, 12, 18 would be the times. And then what people would record. So temperature and pressure and relative humidity, cloud cover, what kind of precipitation, how much precipitation had fallen in the last 6 hours, all those kinds of things. And that made a huge difference because now we see the widespread sharing of data, and it was all taken at exactly the same time to give a snapshot of all the weather around the world all at the same time. That was a huge boost.
Scientists interested in weather forecasting had realized the importance of international collaboration early on and established the International Meteorological Organization in 1873.
The challenge of weather forecasting has always been both local and global. Hello, I'm John Zorman. I was director of the Australian Weather Bureau, Bureau of Meteorology, from 1978 to 2003. I started my career as a weather forecaster, and I particularly have been committed to the international cooperation through the World Meteorological Organization. Certainly in the early days, and then the 1800s, there was much more emphasis just on the local information, but we had to ensure that that was consistent between countries. And so back in the 1870s, the International Meteorological Organization was formed to ensure that all countries, Australia included, particularly Australia because of our position in a largely ocean-covered hemisphere, that we all use the same methods of measuring and collecting the data.
As this international cooperation grew during the early 20th century, the scientific understanding of weather forecasting was accelerating with the dawn of numerical weather prediction.
The work that Fitzroy and Leverrier had done was really just about extrapolating movement of storms. It's similar to what we do now even just using radar, but a bit more complicated, but not much more. And they didn't really understand anything about why the storms were moving the way they were. I'm Neville Nichols. I'm an emeritus professor at Monash, but the first 35 years of my career, I was a meteorologist and climate scientist at the Bureau of Meteorology. That really didn't get into our consciousness until what's called the Bergen School, and particularly a Scandinavian meteorologist, Wilhelm Bjerknes, who in the early decades of the 20th century worked out the equations that govern the movement of and development of systems in the atmosphere. Now, these equations really are just more complicated versions of Newton's laws of motion, F equals ma, more complicated than that, and they're more difficult to solve for the atmosphere. But they're essentially similar to classical physics equations that people have known about for a long time. But it wasn't until Bjerknes put these together in a system that we could actually see a way forward to using mathematics and physics to actually solving how the atmosphere was working at a particular time and forecast how systems would develop, how lows would move and develop, how cold fronts would move and develop. But those equations were really too complicated to solve in the early part of the 20th century. So it seemed like we were up against a sort of a dead end, and Bjerknes and his colleagues and others looked at simplified versions of those equations and simplified ways of solving them to help weather forecasters. And they developed ideas of sort of large masses of air masses and cold fronts and warm fronts that we now see on our weather chart, and simplified ways of solving even very simple versions of those equations using graphical methods and all sorts of things. They were approximations, but they helped, and that's what forecasters relied on for the next 60, 70 years.
Numerical weather prediction, quite frankly, was really helped out by World War II. And because of the war, there were a lot more weather observations that were taken and a lot more stations that were set up in areas that had not had coverage in the past. So those were high latitude stations, so stations that were closer to the Arctic, and also stations that were in the tropics, because those were all parts of the war zone. And because of that, we had massive amounts of data that were available that had never been available before. That's the first thing. The second thing is, because there were so many airplanes involved during the war, there was a massive effort to train meteorologists. So in the U.S. alone, before the war started, there were only 350 meteorologists in the entire country, and almost all of them worked for the U.S. Weather Bureau. During the war, over 7,000 meteorologists were trained. That's a huge jump from 350 to 7,000, right? And this was also true in other countries, not the massive numbers, but these training of meteorologists. So after the war, you now have this cadre of professional meteorologists. You have all of this data. And we have the third piece, which was the development of digital computing. And so with those possibilities together, we see this merging of the opportunity of using computing power, which was initially developed for the war effort, AIM ordnance, quite frankly, and now was being used to take temperature and pressure data, use what are called in meteorology the primitive equations, and then cut those down to something that could actually be used and computed, because those big computers didn't have a whole lot of power, and to produce a very rudimentary surface chart for the next day. And so that's how that happened. But it took a good 10 years from the start of that program in 1946 until it went semi-operational in the mid-1950s.
You're listening to Radio National's Rear Vision with Keri Phillips. This is the story of weather forecasting. Originally, it wasn't as good as local knowledge, but today, accurate predictions can be made using the mathematical expression of the laws of physics to crunch massive quantities of weather data with computers.
Severe and extreme fire danger is forecast across the state today, with high temperatures and strong winds expected.
It was a freezing start in southern Queensland where residents experienced a record-breaking cold snap today. Applethorpe on the Granite Belt recorded a low of minus 6.1 degrees. Warwick and Oakey froze just shy of negative 5, but the Bureau says the cold weather isn't expected to continue.
Temperature records are tumbling as a heat wave continues to sweep across the Northern Territory. The Weather Bureau is warning many parts of Australia will bake next week.
After the Second World War, two things happened. One was the launch of weather satellites, the first in 1960, which allowed meteorologists to track things like the development and movement of storm systems. The other was the creation of the World Meteorological Organization, an agency of the United Nations. The WMO established World Weather Watch, a global system for observing, analysing and forecasting meteorological conditions.
Yes, with the discovery that we could put up both polar orbiting and geostationary satellites, we realised that the time was right for an attempt to produce a really comprehensive global observing system. The international meteorological community took advantage of the ancillary benefits of the Cold War, the fact that the US and the USSR in particular were willing to collaborate for the benefit of the global community, set up an international system called World Weather Watch, and it put very large resources into the development of a global network of satellites and strengthening the other global observing systems, including drifting buoys in the Southern Ocean. And in particular, in 1979, we ran the first global weather experiment, which was an attempt for a year to really make the whole system work to the best possible way so that we could then assess what would be a realistic long-term global observing system and what were the best models and the best formulations of the governing laws for numerical weather prediction so that we could establish a truly cooperative global ongoing weather forecasting and warning system. And that's very much what the Global Weather Experiment and World Weather Watch have given us. World Weather Watch still exists. At that time, it was essential to have at least two so-called World Meteorological Centres. For political reasons, it was decided that one should be in Washington, D.C. in the US, the other in Moscow. But it was also for political as well as geographic reasons, it was believed there should be a third sort of intermediary in some sense. In the 1960s, Melbourne became a World Meteorological Centre of the World Weather Watch, and that was instrumental in the then government agreeing to install big computers in the Weather Bureau in Melbourne. And we performed, I think, a very significant global role as well as benefiting greatly.
Satellites started to increase the amount of data we had about how the atmosphere was looking at any particular time. So we now get millions of observations every day from satellites. So we've got hugely faster computers and huge increase in data. And these are now put together in numerical weather prediction models. And they have a big step forward, which have meant that now we can forecast Melbourne's weather a week ahead, better than we could forecast a day ahead 50 years ago when I first became a meteorologist. So it's a massive increase in our ability to forecast for weather over that 50 years, due primarily to huge increases in computing and huge increases in data from satellites, combined with these equations, which were first worked out by Wilhelm Bjergnes and his colleagues back 100 years ago.
Are forecasters still using the same equations?
Yes, the equations that were first put together in the early 20th century. They're what we call the primitive equations, not because they're simple, but because they underlie everything. We used very complicated maths and physics to put the equations together, to solve them, and to make sure we're getting all of this data put into them.
Is a weather model then a combination of these mathematical equations and an enormous amount of data crunched in a supercomputer?
A model is, at its simplest idea, it is just a way we solve Newton's laws of motion, force equals mass by acceleration, but we do that at the same time at thousands of points across the atmosphere, right across the globe, from the surface to kilometres above the surface. So thousands of little grid points. We estimate what the weather is doing at that time, what the temperature is, what the pressure is, the density of the air and the wind movements. We put all of that together and solve basically 7 equations, but we solve them all simultaneously across the world at all these levels. And the only way we can do that is by massive supercomputers to do it all at once. That's why it was impossible to do this sort of forecasting 100 years ago. We needed enormous computers to do it. And we also needed this enormous amount of data to actually tell us what the atmosphere was looking like at this very moment, not just where I'm standing, but where I'm standing and several kilometers above me and right across the world. So we need all of those observations all at the same time, and we need to put them into the computer, which then solves these equations all at the same time. And those equations tell us how the atmosphere will evolve in the next couple of minutes. And then we do it again, and it tells us how it will evolve a few minutes after that. So it can actually tell us how the atmosphere will evolve, how things like low pressure systems will move around and will develop, will get more intense or weaken. And we can do that out to 7 days, 10 days now. These models are just making these forecasts a few minutes at a time.
Is there still a role for humans in weather forecasting?
Oh, of course, because we're still the ones that have to interpret the charts, right? So the computer model gives us a picture of the current surface and then all of the levels going up to the top of the atmosphere, okay? And then it gives us that picture for right now, at the time that the observations were taken, and then at 24 hours, at 36 hours, at 48 hours, at 72 hours, and in some cases out to like 7 to 10 days. All right. So we have all of this model output, which are all of these charts from the surface to the upper atmosphere, and then out at various periods out to 7 to 10 days. And the meteorologists get these charts and they look at them and they discuss what's going on. And then they're the ones that tap up the forecasts and say, okay, this is what's going to happen for your area. Because, of course, the model output is for the whole world, right? It's global models. So it's for the whole world. It's not for somebody's individual town. So there has to be a meteorologist there who's looking at the area and says, okay, for this area, this is going to be the forecast. This other area that's also part of my forecasting zone, which is different from where I'm actually sitting, I'm going to have a different forecast for them. So like for in Australia, whoever is forecasting for Melbourne, they're not going to have the same forecast in Melbourne as for Sydney or for Brisbane, right? So you have to be able to look at the different parts of the country where you are and take into account, you know, what the topography is there, what the other factors are, and then what your charts say at the surface to the upper levels for the outgoing days. Very important to have the person there. Because when you're doing a local forecast, you have to consider your microclimate. So let's say you're in a big city, then you have your own microclimate there because there's so much concrete and asphalt and big buildings and things that are putting off heat, right? And that's different than if you live 50 kilometers outside of town and there happens to be a big lake close by. Right? So then you have to consider that while you're making the forecast. And it's only a person who's familiar with the area who's going to be able to do that.
It has been suggested that the whole process can be automated, that we can get all the data in from satellites and radar and automatic weather stations. They'll go into a big computer and then the computer produces forecasts automatically. Theoretically, that's possible, but I think there's always going to be humans needed. It's similar to a doctor. Do we need a doctor because we can feed all our symptoms into a medical program and it'll then diagnose a suggested course of action? But you do need discussion. With the weather, if we could say exactly where every molecule of air is, we could produce a system that would tend to run by itself. But we don't, because we don't know where every molecule is. There's uncertainties involved. And the uncertainties are where human beings come in. And we do have ways of now categorising uncertainties, we can say this particular forecast we've got, it's a pretty sure one and we're fairly certain of the outcome. Although then there's other situations where a very uncertain forecast is involved. And the way the computer looks at these, the computer will actually produce a run of forecasts, and then the initial conditions are only changed very slightly just to see what happens. And when that occurs, sometimes the forecast stays pretty much the same. Other times, even a very small change in initial conditions will produce a cascade of different results. And in that sort of situation, we say there's a fair amount of uncertainty in the forecast. So that sort of thing is where human beings comes in, and you do need a conversation with people to give some idea about how sure we are of this particular forecast.
The mercury is soaring in Darwin. The Weather Bureau says Darwin has experienced 34 days above 35 degrees this year, breaking a 2016 record. It also hit a record 10th straight day above 35.
So over the last couple of months, the NT has experienced some pretty extraordinary heatwave conditions, and we've seen a huge amount of temperature records being broken.
All kinds of weather records are constantly being broken, and obviously climate change presents new challenges for weather forecasters. But just how predictable is the weather?
Well, that depends. It depends on where you are, and it depends on the circumstances, for instance, the time of the year. So as an example of that, I spent 2 years leading the weather forecast office at the NATO base in Keflavik, Iceland. In Iceland, in the winter, the weather changed about every minute and a half. Okay? So it was really hard. It was really hard to predict. But when I was stationed in Hawaii, we could practically use the same forecast day after day after day, year round, because it just didn't change that much. So it really depends on your location, and it depends on the time of the year. For the most part, if you are in an area where you're under the influence of a high pressure zone at the time, your weather today is probably going to be the same as the weather tomorrow. There's just not going to be a whole lot of change. But if it's the winter time where you have cold fronts coming through every 4 or 5 days for people who live in the mid latitudes, then that gets a little tricky. Less tricky if you're in the middle of a continent, because you've got all of those observations that are leading up to you, and a lot more tricky if you live on the edge of the continent when the water is there and all of your systems are coming in over the water. So is it predictable? Sure. How predictable it is depends on where you're living, what time of the year it is, how close you are to the poles. If you're in the tropics, it's easier to predict. If you're closer to the poles, not so much.
Christine Harper, Professor of the History and Philosophy of the Earth Sciences at the University of Copenhagen. The other guests were Dr. John Zillman, who was Commonwealth Director of Meteorology from 1978 and President of the World Meteorological Organization from 1995 until 2003, Emeritus Professor Richard Nichols from Monash University and Richard Whittaker, both meteorologists with decades of experience, mostly with our Bureau of Meteorology. Wei Nguyen is the sound engineer for this Rear Vision. Bye from Keri Phillips.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.